again, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Financial 15, the podcast where we try to answer all of your financial questions in roughly 15 minutes. And as I've said before, we don't include our friendly back and forth banter in that because, you know, then our 15 turns into 45 and then we just look like a bunch of liars. So, you know, 15 minutes of answers. I'm your host, Ashley Nichols. And of course, as always, I'm here with senior wealth advisor and senior portfolio manager, Stephen Biddle.
Hello, everyone.
Now, we record these episodes on a monthly basis, and while we do cover a very wide array of topics on this show, we have narrowed our focus to the world of financial planning. Financial planning itself is a huge topic with a lot of avenues to go down, and we're kind of slowly exploring each of those avenues with our senior wealth planning consultant, Sean Harding. Hello, Sean. It's nice to see you again.
Hello, hello.
Now, again, we do record these episodes on a monthly basis, and you can find them all on our website, and that's at www.biddlejohnstonwmteam.ca. It's going to be under the newsletters, podcasts, and videos tab. And any questions, comments that you might have that you'd like us to cover possibly in future episodes, you can send all of that to my email at ashley.nichols@nbpcd.com. So in our last episode, we covered a bit more about debt, how we might be able to reduce it in higher inflationary periods, how we need to have financial discussions with our partners early on in our relationship, so we're all kind of on the same page about money. And that being said, again, if you have any questions on the previous episode, you can let us know. But today we're going to explore a different way of thinking about financial planning, and that's going to be with specific goal planning. So whether it is paying down debt, saving for a home, for vacations, your kids' future, what have you, anything along those lines, you can still use a financial plan. It doesn't just have to be a budget expense sheet on Microsoft Excel. You know, you can get a little more in depth. So Sean, Stephen, you guys go right ahead and you let us know how, you know, especially millennials like myself can have some goal planning in place so that we can achieve what we want to in life with our money. That'd be great.
Sure. All right. This topic, I gave a little bit of thought. And the one thing I would say to everyone, obviously, those who have unlimited or seemingly unlimited cash flows don't need to worry about this. But for most people, the wants exceed the means. So you kind of have to put them in order, right? You have to put what you want in some kind of priority list. If that's reducing debt, that could be one of them. It could be putting kids through school, right? Post-secondary education. There's the retirement planning piece. There could be buying your first home or buying a bigger home because your family's growing or you have different wishes. You kind of buying a car. Right, there's all these things that start to add up, and then you have to look at your cash flow going, well, I still need to live. I can't just dedicate all my cash flow to just these priorities. So you kind of have to put them in order and say, okay, which ones am I going to tackle? Now, as a planner, I look at it, sometimes the best way to solve isn't to try and put all of these goals together at the same time. It's really hard to try and save for everything at the same time within a relatively restricted cash flow. So if you're earlier in your career, for example, that's really the case where your cash flow is not where it could be when you're going to be later in your career. So sometimes when I build a plan, especially for our younger clients, I will sequence things. And I'll say, okay, so we need to get you a better home. We need to get you renos. We need to get you the kids' education. And I'll start sequencing those in first. And I'll actually put stuff like retirement planning later, saying, you know what? You have plenty of time to save for your retirement goals, say between the ages of, I'm just going to use just random numbers here, but say between the ages of, say, 35 or even 40, up to retirement, right? You've got a 20-year window there to be saving. And maybe we focused on getting you into that home. Maybe we get you the kids' education. Those kinds of things maybe need to come first. And we just focus on those goals first and then knock those off. Then the next trick is looking at what tools are available. Right. So we were talking earlier about there's, you know, for education, we got RESPs. Then there's these new accounts that are coming out, the FHSA, which really all of us are looking at, right? We're trying to figure this one out.
Yeah, exactly, Sean. Also, when you're talking about the goals too, right, is at the beginning, when you try to pay down, say, the kids' education or buying the house, those usually come along with debt too, right? And as interest rates have risen, debt becomes much more expensive, right? And a lot of people don't look at debt the way I do. And what I mean by that is, you know, let's say theoretically you have a line of credit, and with the way things have changed now, it's probably north of 7%. For you to do better in an investment, that 7% is equal to a guaranteed after-tax rate of return. Think about that, right? So if you ever think, so I could get 7% by investing, or I can get 7% by or having a line of credit. Well, the line of credit, that is much higher, because the line of credit, you don't pay taxes on it, right? And, you know, for example, 7% in interest, well, guess what? That's taxable. 7% in dividends is taxable, right? So you always got to look at that side of things. And as you said, you know, the financial industry has also made it easier to segment. You know, as we talked about, you know, for retirement, you have RSPs, you know, you have tax-free savings accounts nowadays, and you have RESPs for the education, and you have the FSHA, which is the first home savings account, as Sean mentioned. And, you know, I think what I'll just jump in here and just explain what this is. It's a really neat idea that the government has come out with to try to help individuals save for a home. So it can only be used by first-time home buyers, and you can contribute up to $40,000. But like an RSP, believe it or not, the contributions into that account are tax deductible, and the withdrawals that you take out come out tax-free, which is great. And, you know, there was something called the RSP Home Buyers Plan, but in this case, you don't have to pay that money back. So that's a great option, right? And, you know, there's not a whole lot of conditions. One, you have to be a resident of Canada, and you have to be 18 years of age. So that's kind of easy one for most people. But there's also that stipulation to be a first-time home buyer. It means you have not lived in a home that was owned either jointly or solely with your spouse or common law partner at any time in the calendar year before the account was opened, or at any time in the preceding 4 calendar years. So if you have a place that you're living with your partner, you're not going to be able to qualify for this. So that's something to keep in mind. Also too, is as the FSHA matures and must be closed, it can, you know, there's other things you can do, right? It can be transferred over to an RSP. It can go to your RIF. There's lots of different things, but that has to be done on the 15th anniversary of the individual's first opening of the account, or by the time you turn 71, right? So it gives you lots and lots of options to grow that money. And the other thing that's nice about it, which is something that a lot of people unfortunately are going to miss, is that you do get to put in $40,000. You do get to do an annual contribution of $8,000 a year, but those contribution limits start and accumulate once you've opened the plan. So you can't, as with your tax-free savings account, when you turn 18, you get to accumulate that regardless if you have a plan opened. In the FSHA, you have to open the plan. You could literally open it, leave it blank for as long as you wanted to, and then you're like, okay, now I'm going to put $8,000 a year for the next X number of years, right?
Right.
Whereas with the tax-free savings account, you can literally be, you know, 55 years old and you're like, I've never put a penny in there. And we're like, great, send us $83,500. You're good to go, right? So right. So that's a big thing with the FSHA, is that it has to be opened, right? So that, I think that's a really big one. Another one, if you put contributions in there for a spouse, you don't get the spousal deduction like you do with a spousal RSP. So these things are all beginning to open up now across the financial industry. Everyone's trying to grapple of how we're going to actually maneuver and do this, but they are good to go. So that's another one, right? Back to the old thing is people said, hey, let's throw money in a tax-free savings account and let that grow to buy a house.
Right.
Right. this is a better alternative, but unfortunately with that asterisk about you can't have ever owned one before or living with a spouse who owns one.
Well, I know one circumstance, or personally, my eldest son, who is now second year apprentice, but still living at home, that's what we're going to be using, is he's socking his money away into one of those FHSAs for that very purpose, that he's earning money, he can deduct it, fantastic, right? And then the whole point of him staying at home is so that he can save up his down payment so that he can go out and purchase his first home when he's done his ticket and whatever else. So it's a huge tool right there just for that to help launch kids. I was thinking also about the what you said earlier about we had the first-time home buyer, which still applies. And I was reading earlier that you can combine the two. But I was trying to think of what circumstances would you ever combine the two? And it occurred to me, it's like, oh, wait, divorce. People that divorce and separate and you end up losing your home as part of it, you can reset yourself. 4 years later, you could, and if you've already got money set aside in your RRSP, and if you strategically place yourself using one of these FHSAs, 4 years later, say you rent for 4 years, boom, you've requalified and you could actually pull down the $40,000 out of the FHSA, another $35,000 out of your RRSP. That's a pretty good down payment and could conceivably, I'm not saying it will, but could get you out of the CMHC fees. Right? If you put a large enough down payment and you're not paying those CMHC fees, it could actually be work out in your favor.
Yep, that's a great point. Right? There's these products and there's a lot of things out there. And that's why, once again, the financial planning and dealing with a planner makes sense, because you know, that's our job to find these things out, right? And like just throwing it in, you know, the 0% checking account, that's a long slog to make that money up, right?
Exactly.
And with things the way they are with rates, and you know, I don't think we're going to see those ultra low rates come back again, right? And that's something that people have got to come to grips with, right? When you really look at it, of where rates were, you know, when the great financial crisis came, these governments responded in very aggressive ways and drove down interest rates to historically low. And I think some people kind of come to think that was the way it was, right? Like, so from 2008 to 2000, and let's call it 22, rates averaged about 2.5%. But if you go back further, like from 1990 to 2007, it was more like 5.86%. That's probably more reasonable. So people expecting, you know, I'm going to get that mortgage back at 2% again. I think that's a large amount of hope, and hopefully people aren't budgeting for that, right? And
right.
So just all debt, right? Debt, the whole question of debt versus investments going to come back. And you hear lots of these stories where people had mortgages, older individuals, and by older, I mean, you know, there's still people 50, 60, 70 years old with mortgages. And it made sense because you were paying 2% on a mortgage. But unfortunately, they forgot the other part was, because you were paying that, then you should have taken that theoretical bigger mortgage payment and invested it. So you had the lump sum to pay down that mortgage when it came due, right? Mm-hmm. And now what you're finding is individuals who are near the end of their work careers are going, oh my God, my payments are double and I don't have the income and I have no ability to generate more income, right? Like there's so many jobs out there and older individuals have harder time finding those jobs too, right? So it's that's another part. And like you said, it's, you've got to put those goals down and figure out what you want to do. And as you know, with school, it's not getting cheaper.
Nope. With plans, I'm seeing more and more plans where people are carrying mortgages well into their retirement years. Whereas the rule of thumb 20 years ago was you had to have all your debts paid off when you hit retirement.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing these mortgages just carry on into the 70s, early 80s. It's almost becoming I'm not going to say routine, but I'm seeing more and more of it. And when I started out in my career, I was a lender. I was in banking, and getting a $250,000 mortgage was a big deal. Now I'm seeing young people, young professionals, they don't bat an eyelash at $800,000. Or they weren't until these new interest rates.
Because it was $800,000 at 2%, right?
Exactly.
And the conversation was, okay, I can spend $1,500 a month on the mortgage payment. How big of a house can I have? Is there any way I can make it bigger? Okay, great. I'm in, right? No, and the banks, bless their souls, they're not going to sit there and go, dude, if rates go up to five, like, are you going to be able to afford it? It just won't do that, right? And now you're seeing that there's a lot of people that are looking at things and going, ooh, this is expensive. Or even like people did home renovations and stuff. Just talking to someone the other day, they did home renos, they spent $70,000. On their line, it was 2.5%. Now they're like, oh, it's 7.2, right? And it's like, okay, now can you pay it down? It's like, well, no, that's why I took out the line, because I don't have the money, right? Just like credit card debt, that's even going up. It's always been ridiculous, but now it's more ridiculous, right? So I think you're going to see more issues with debt present themselves, because Canada is one of the more indebted nations out there. You look at how much is in debt in this country, and it's pretty scary.
We didn't have that correction quite the way the US did.
Not even close. Our housing market went sideways. The US went down, 30, 40%. Like the US, I think, is only about 10% higher than it was in 2008, and we're like about 40% higher. It's insane how much the houses went up here. And everyone says, I find the conversation sort of funny in a way when they're talking about, hey, we need to make homes more affordable. Well, yeah, we do. But the only way you can make homes affordable is for their prices to go down dramatically. But everyone wants, I want more affordable housing, but I don't want the house that I have to drop 30 to 40% in price, right? You
That's the
can't have one
downside.
without the other.
Yeah,
The good news
exactly.
is housing's affordable. Bad news is your house just dropped 45%, right? Because rates aren't going to go back to two. I just don't see
No.
that happening. So,
I do see that there's going to be a shift. The high-end homes are going to, they might correct more because there's going to be a group of people that are just going to downsize. They're just naturally going to start downsizing their homes, or at least going to a different value to reduce their debt load and get the payments back into a range of what they can afford, right? So I could see people that are sitting on a $900, $1 million home and suddenly going, yeah, we need to look at that $500,000-$600,000 range to shrink things back.
Well, also just shrink the size of the house, right? Kids have moved out. They're sitting with a 3,000 square foot house, right? And they're like, do we need that? He just had an exact conversation with the client. They had a three, two of them have a 3,000 square foot home. They're like, this is nuts. Sold it, bought a 1,500 square foot condo,
There you go.
right? And for those, it worked out great. And they literally sold their house in 2 hours. But,
Oh, wow, that's good.
All the market down in Calgary is insane.
Okay, gotcha.
It's nuts. They told me they basically, in they built this house, lived in it for 5 years, sold it in 2 hours at a premium to what they were asking, and then bought a condo that they were also looking at before they built at the same price as it was then. So condos have been flat and the housing's went up, right? So it's, as the guy says, a win-win for him, which doesn't happen too often, but
No, that's
it's,
fantastic. Because
yep.
I recently heard of a couple that had started building, and this is in Edmonton. They started building 2 years ago. They bought a lot, but between interest rates and cost overruns, the build went just ballooned. And when it was finally completed, they just flipped it. They just sold it. They never actually went into the house or took possession of the house. They just flipped it. And thankfully, they got out of it pretty quickly, but they were saddled with something that they just couldn't even afford. It was just too much.
Yeah, and I think there is, like you said, a lot of those, in that 900 to 1.3 million dollar range. There's a lot of those homes out there, and I just look all the time. It's like, how can people afford these? And I think the answer we're going to find in a year or two is
They
they
can't.
can't.
We're starting to see that a little bit in Ontario. A lot of those million-dollar homes now, you'll see them on just real estate websites and whatnot to see the ones that have sold. So listed, let's just give an example. Like one I saw a few weeks ago was in it originally listed for 1.2 million, and it was just a standard house. It like you know in Ontario, a 1.2 million dollar house is nothing like what you would get for 1.2 million dollars in Alberta. So standard house, 1.2 million. I believe it was on the market for. I think it was on the market for 2 or 3 months. It took quite a while. And the price every 2 or 3 weeks would go down. So 1.2 million, I think they ended up selling it for like, I think it was around 850,000.
Wow.
Right. And I think now in like cottage country around, you know, all of our Great Lakes and whatnot, you see all of these cottages now are up for sale because like that's kind of the first priority. The first thing that people will let go of, right, is like their vacation home. So there's lots of cottages for sale right now, lots of boats and, you know, extracurricular vehicles, ATVs, all that kind of stuff, like Auto Trader, Marketplace. They're flooded right now with all of these things because it's like you say, Stephen, everyone bought these things thinking, whoo, like 2% interest rate. Look how much we can afford. And now they can't afford it.
And it's also the end of the season, right? It's also the end of the season where they're going, okay, we live in Alberta, October, boats out. November payments, December payments, January, February, March, April. So I've got 7 months of payments on something that's just sitting there.
Yeah.
Maybe I should just not have it anymore.
Right. Yeah. And then, and you have to look at it. And like I've met some people that are very avid boaters, but this past season, the boating season hasn't been great, at least talking to some of the boat owners that I know. And they actually count out in hours. How many hours did they use their boat in the season versus those payments? And they're suddenly going, you know what? We're just not getting the use out of it that we originally thought we were going to.
And the boats nowadays are so expensive, right? Like if you want to make your head pop and you don't know what boats are, just go Google onto Martin Sports, right? And you've got like these Mastercraft boats, the quote unquote entry level boats, like $125,000, right? Yeah. And there's boats that are $300,000. It's like that's a house.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
That you're using on the weekend for 20 weeks.
Exactly. Not to speak of the operating costs and the fuel costs that go with that.
Oh, and the insurance. Yeah. Everything else, right?
And the time, you know, the time cleaning the boat, getting it put away, getting everything ready. Like, Stephen, you guys have a vacation home, like, you know, all the time.
But our boat definitely isn't in that range. That's for sure.
Yeah. No. You guys have like a dinghy. So, you know,
we have a black and white, Orca thing that we all sit on when we blow it up before.
Yeah, it's actually just an inflatable. We put a fan in the water and boo, and then off we go. Yeah,
exactly. We got a 1 horsepower trolling motor on the back.
Yeah,
exactly.
There we go.
Takes us 4.5 hours to go around the lake.
Oh man.
Anyway,
I was going to say, so Sean, when we talk about things like specific goal planning and all this kind of stuff, I mean, so what exactly would that look like in a financial plan like that you would put together? You talked about how, you know, you start prioritizing and whatnot. Now, do you break things down in years? Do you break, like, how exactly does it work when people want to make those goals?
Think of how a retirement plan is kind of built, right? Mm-hmm. There's a target date. There's a target amount that we want. So we break it down exactly the same way, but for different specific. So another big one that comes up a lot is, so for example, education planning, right? So how many years we have before the kids are going to post-secondary? How much do we want to be allocating for that? Mm-hmm. How much needs, what is the current savings rate, right? So a lot of people, they just go to, you know, the RESP kind of standard number, right? Mm-hmm. So if you put in that 2,500, you get that magic 20%. So your 2,500 now turns into, that is, I'm going to say 95% of people, that's exactly where they go. So, and I'll take that number and I'll project it out and I'll say, okay, so your kid is going to be able to get $15,000 a year for 4 years. I'm just using numbers right now. Is that enough? Sometimes families say, well, you know, I want my kid to be able to do a master's. Or I have the medical professionals that say, no, one of my kids, I want them to be able to go to med school. Well, the RESP, just doing the kind of that standard $2,500 a month or a year, sorry, $2,500. So $2,500 a year all the way up to age 17, it's not going to give them enough for med school.
That's right. Yeah.
It's not going to give them enough, perhaps even for a master's. So then we have to kind of plan above and beyond an RESP. Then we say, okay, so what other, are we going to set money aside in a non-registered account or a TFSA for their purposes? I lay that into the plan and we start doing the withdrawals at the specific dates. And then I have to kind of manage all those cash flows and make sure that they're not going into debt every year, right? We're not going into the red every year. So there's only so much you can do, right? So then they say, well, we also want a vacation home. Okay, so now we might have a conflict.
It goes back to prioritizing, right?
It's going to be, what's your priority? Is it going to be putting your kids through post-secondary school, or is it the vacation home? But having both is going to be challenging. And I think that's where people sometimes need to put a little bit of a reality check, or I'll do it through the planning process. It's kind of, this is just math.
Yeah.
Right? It's not, it's not a judgment or anything like that. It's a matter of, okay, what are your priorities? And we keep taking that out of your cash flow, given the current costs and the current rates of return. What does that look like for you?
Yeah.
And then you decide from there, okay, we can do this, or we might need to scale back on the vacation home. We might just scale that back to say, we're going to do a family trip every year and that's it. We're going to call it quits after that. You know, everyone, it's the beauty of the plan is that once it's laid out and it's all math, you get to pick and choose what you can and cannot do and what's got to give, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a constraint and it's like, okay, something's got to give. So you pick which on the list is going to come off or get chiseled down.
Yeah. I think another thing that comes with it too is make sure what those goals are has the time horizon, and make sure the time horizon fits with the investments. So perfect example, had a client a year ago saying, you know, sold my house, I've got X dollars, I want to do something with it because I'm planning on buying another house in the next 12 to 18 months. Well, there was literally one investment option, and that was either a GIC or a high interest savings account.
Right.
Because you don't want to be putting investment or investing money in vehicles that aren't designed that way. If you're looking at equities, it's 5+ years, right? As I said to the client, I said, I'm sure you'll be happy if it, you know, this grows by 10% by the time you buy your new house. I said, but I don't think you're going to be very happy if it's 15% lower.
Yeah. Right.
And those, that's a variability that happens in the market. So when we're talking about the goal planning, you also want to set aside money as well, right? So when you're even looking at your asset mix, you know, we'll have some clients say, oh, you know, I'm a little bit worried about the markets because I'm going to retire in 2 years. And my comment to them is like, how much money are you taking out in 2 years, right? It's just because you retire, you don't need to change all of your investment objectives because you're not going to take out, you know, literally your entire RSP the day you retire, right?
Yeah.
And so you say to a client, it's like, how much are you looking for? And then when you look at things, look at bonds, look at cash in a portfolio, and those are the things that you can take out fairly quickly, right? If you need money right away, there's the cash. You know, bonds don't usually vary that much where equities do more, right? So that's where, when we look at things too, we're looking at the time horizon, what the goals are, and where it is, right? And we sometimes with clients actually set up two separate accounts, right?
Yeah.
Where one account is just, okay, this is your, I might need this because I might be buying a car in the next 6 months, like you said, whatever it is. And so that is invested different than this is my money I'm using for my retirement, or this is the RESP money. Because your kids are going to school, if you start early, a long way down the road.
Yeah.
And they have different objectives, different risk profiles. So, you know, it's not a one-stop shop. So if you're ever talking to someone, they say, oh, just throw it all in here. It's like, no, it can't be done that way.
Yeah.
Because the ramifications are huge. Like
down
payments, if it's a bit bigger, fantastic. If it's way lower, catastrophic. That's not the risk reward you want.
In the planning world, there's the name that we kind of use is bucketing, where we actually have, okay, what is money that is 8-10 years down the road? What is something that we're going to use in the next 3 to 7 years, right? Because we can do something more aggressive. So the stuff that we're never going to use, definitely go way more aggressive. And then, so we actually say, okay, well, how much money do we need to have in each one of these buckets?
Yep.
Specific to what's trying to get accomplished, what the goals are. And we just kind of pool those money. So when I'm building a plan, I could say, okay, bucket of money that's going to get used in the next 2 years, we've only got it at 4% max. And that's just because of the rates that we have today. It might be more like 3%. And then the stuff that's not going to get used for 10 years, I can put a higher rate of return to that only because we're now able to invest a little more aggressively and it can weather the storm.
Yeah. And I think that's another key. When you have a plan, like you'll have clients who have more than enough money and they're like, oh my God, the market's down 10% or 15% or whatever it is. I've got to do something. It's like, why do you have to do it? How much is allocated out of your net worth to spend in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, right? Like, you know, I don't want to be flippant, but you know, if you're 50 years old and the market dropped 30% and you're retiring in 15 years, like, I don't want to say it flippantly, but it's like, so what? It doesn't matter. It's not like you don't need that money today. But, you know, if you're buying a house with the money and it drops 20%, then you got a big problem.
Yeah.
Right. So exactly. It's like along with that bucketing also gives you the ability to have a bigger picture view of where you are and where you're going. It allows you, like Sean says, to, you know, weather that volatility. And, you know, from our perspective, we do a great job of volatility minimization. We manage money very differently from a lot of people out there. We raise cash quite often, and we've managed over the last 5, 7, 8, 9 years to have literally 1/3 the volatility the market has. You know, COVID was down 30%. Mm-hmm. We were down 11, right? And if you never get those big drops, you can weather the storm much easier. You don't want to be making mistakes that will cause your retirement and your plan to blow up.
Exactly. Yeah. There was a plan I did a few years back that this conversation makes me think of it, is they were heading into retirement and one of them, it was a couple, one of them really had a risk aversion, right? It was, but to just put all the money into a bank account or a GIC wasn't really realistic either, because it was a lot of money. It was just going to be a disservice to their overall plan, because inflation was going higher than what the interest rates were at that time. So we did the math and said, okay, a really conservative portfolio, in a worst case scenario, how much would it drop by, and how many years would it take for, or how many months would it take for it to recover? And in that particular scenario, it was going to take about 18 months for, in a worst case scenario, for their portfolio to recover. That was kind of what we did the math on. So 18 months. So what I did is I said, okay, you're spending, you need X amount of dollars every month in spending, and it takes 18 months for the portfolio to recover in a worst case scenario. And we pulled that amount out as essentially cash and put that to cash and GICs and said, here's your 18 months of spending, so that if the worst case scenario happens and it takes 18 months for your portfolios to recover, you can live off this cash and wait for that, the rest of the portfolio to recover. And that kind of appeased both sides of the equation. We have a nice rate of return, not extreme, by no means a big rate of return, like in terms of growth rates, but at least we were able to get the bulk of the investments growing at, you know, 4, 5, 6%. And they had the peace of mind saying, well, we have 18 months worth of spending just set aside here.
Yeah.
You got to have that sleep at night portfolio.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter what it is, because they're like, okay, it's down 10, 11, 12. Oh my God, we got to pull out, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And you're done. And another thing you said there, Sean, you said, you know, if it recovers in 18 months, you know, little history lesson, there are periods of time where the market takes much, much longer than that, right? 1966 to 1982, 0% return on the S&P 500. 2000 to 2013, people kind of forget, it was called the decade of darkness, 0% return on the S&P 500, right? Mm-hmm. So there are periods of time where the market goes sideways for a long period of time with lots of volatility, right? And those times usually are when the Federal Reserve is raising rates, lending standards are getting tighter, and inflation is coming out, and a disproportionate number of stocks, or maybe that's not the right word, a very few number of stocks control the index.
Like,
kind of sounds like today.
Like, I was about to say, this is starting to sound familiar.
And what's really nice too, like just kind of going back to the planning side, is that if you have clients that are worried about that kind of stuff, like Sean, you were talking about, you know, you have those clients who are worried about the volatile side of things and 18 months, you know, having to take that cash out so they're comfortable. The financial plans that we can put together with our programs, like, you can make those scenarios. You can make to say, like, this is what your money can do in this scenario. This is what your money can do in this scenario. This is how it'll affect it if the market goes down, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's a visual stimulant for, you know, clients to actually see, because it's one thing to say it. It's a whole other thing to actually see it. It can either put some fears to rest to say, okay, yes, we will have money at the end. If, you know, the market goes down 20% and takes a while to recover, it really won't affect us because the bars are all still green. We don't see any red. Things are fine. So that's just one thing that I really, really like about our financial plans, is that we can put those scenarios in if you
we stress test them.
Exactly. Yeah. You stress test it against like the worst things that you could possibly think of. And, you know, if life is just a bunch of roses and daisies and everything's great, you know, you can see it from that perspective as well, which is
as really we say, nice. Actually, you overestimate your costs, mm-hmm. you underestimate the return. And if we're completely wrong and you don't spend enough money and you make way too much money, you know what? I'm sorry. You are financially massively independent.
Yeah. We're so sorry for your financial security. Like, oh, yeah, it must be hard. Yes. Tough life.
Really sorry that you have too much money and then you're going to complain because you have too much taxes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
That's for a different story, isn't it, Sean? The classic, I don't want to pay this amount of taxes. We're like, well, there is an alternative. We could lose all your money and then you'll have no taxes. No, I don't want to do that one. I want the other alternative. You mean the one that doesn't exist?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think today, I mean, we covered a really good topic of, like you say, Sean, just prioritizing your needs and your wants and ensuring that your cash flow, you have enough of it to cover. And sometimes we got to put things to the side. Sometimes we need reality checks. And, you know, I'll probably say it in every single episode that we have, is that, you know, it's so much easier to hear it from somebody with the education, the professional, someone who's done it for years, as opposed to yourself just making your Excel spreadsheets or, you know, going through an app and just doing it yourself. Because when you don't have that education, when you don't have that experience of all these different financial planning scenarios, you know, things can get missed and mistakes can be made and, you know, opportunities might not be seized. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep. The importance of professional advice is very important.
As they say, it's professional advice may be expensive, but doing it yourself is so much more. You talk to lawyers, right? Lawyers love when people do their own wills. And I asked them once and say, because we make so much more money when it's all contested.
Yeah. Because it's all done wrong. It's our favorite.
You know, the number of times I've actually done plans for people that they have a really good idea and they actually send in their spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, you're in the right ballpark. Hear me. Let me just tweak this for you and make you think of a few other things. And essentially all it is I'm providing them with a second opinion saying, yes, you are okay. There's a few things that your spreadsheet didn't quite cover on, but yes, you're still okay. But I'm telling you now, as an experienced planner, telling you, yep, you were on the right track and you're good to go.
Yeah. And we can make you more okay, right? Like you said, this Absolutely. Is great. One thing you haven't considered is A, B, and C, because this is what happens after this plan, like passing, you know, on assets to family, right? Yeah. Or here's something you might want to do beforehand, right? Just because you can't know it all yourself. You can't. I don't think you can just hit maybe you can do it now with this new artificial intelligence. Like, I've got $5, make me rich in a million years.
Yeah.
How do I do it? AI plan.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. But that's another thing too, is even as us, you know, professionals in the field, we don't have all the answers either. So the beauty of, you know, working with a team like ours is we have the other people to reach out to. We have the extended team of more professionals. It's, you know, Sean, you start preparing a plan for somebody and they have a business to, you know, put into the plan and sell off. Well, we have people that might have more answers to the questions, or, you know, well, I'm also thinking about what my estate plan is going to look like. Well, we have somebody to connect with.
Well, and that's part of the conversation, is sometimes the finances are only part of it. It's, oh, you have a son, daughter, grandchild that's got a disability. Okay, so how is that going to factor in here? What does your will say? When was the last time you even looked at your wills?
Yeah.
And we need to actually see how the money flows and translates into people.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not just the money. It's also, this is people's lives. Right? That's your right. lives. It's how everyone's going to get impacted. And we need to look at that.
Yeah.
It's more of a well, it's more of a complete wealth plan or a life plan, right? Like you said,
Exactly.
there's so many
Absolutely.
different pieces to it. And you know, that's what we do, right? You know, I have a decent planning background, but Sean knows way more than I do. And you know what? There's things that come up where Sean doesn't know the answer. And we have, you know, a team in Toronto where he can, you know, talk to tax specialists, right? All of a sudden he's talking to someone, they say, oh, by the way, I'm dual citizen, I have US taxes, I've got this. And you know, that's getting into stuff that's, you know, a little bit more difficult. So Sean has people to go. We have our trust and estate people we can look at. We have business valuation people we can look at, even from the insurance side, right? There are certain situations where insurance can be incredibly beneficial to your wealth plan, especially if you're business owners, right? And those are things we so we've got an entire team. It's not just my pretty face. It's like there's other people behind me.
Yeah, that's right.
No,
Exactly.
the business owners have a there's a layer of complexity there where there are a little it's a little more complicated, and the taxes can get a lot more complicated. But the beauty is with corporations especially is there's a lot more tax planning that can be done. Whereas, you know, individuals such as myself that are just employees and have, you know, can only rely on pensions and RRSPs, there's a world of a whole other world for business owners out there
Well,
that
that's kind of
we
like
can
the RSP's
capitalize on.
X dollars. Like you said, the RSP's X dollars, you take it out, it's income.
That's it.
When you pass away, it's income. What can we do to minimize it? Well, you can take money out early, but you're still paying taxes on those. You're just not necessarily paying as much as when you pass. It's not monumental.
Well, I think we've overextended our time as we like to do on this show every time.
We've got to change it, actually. It's called the Financial 50.
But yeah,
Yeah,
I think
that's
at
it.
this point we might need to change it to something along
Yeah,
that
I think we're gonna get sued. We're gonna get sued pretty soon because
Misinformation,
certainly, yes.
misleading.
It's almost like, oh, that's not 15 minutes.
No.
But I think that this is a good segue maybe into our next episode where we talk a little bit more heavily on how an investment profile needs to, you know, your investment banker and your financial planner need to be able to talk to each other and have those conversations together so we can see how investments and all that kind of stuff can affect your, you know, your financial future essentially and how it can all kind of be integrated into your plan. So maybe that can be something that we chat about in the next episode. But for now, we're going to end this episode for today. And again, if anyone has any questions or if you want further explanations into what we did talk about today, I know we sometimes go off on our tangents and then it takes a bit to get back to our original questioning. So if you have any follow-ups for us, definitely send it to me. I'd be happy to pass it along to Stephen or Sean. And my email again is ashley.nichols@nbpcd.com. And you can go back and listen to any of our previous episodes on our website. And that is at biddlejohnstonwmteam.ca. So for now, we will say goodbye to everybody and we will see you next month for our next installment of the Financial 50. Approximation, the Financial 50. You all have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you all, chat with you all next time.
Thanks, Ashley. And also too, just a little thing is you could feel free to pass these podcasts on to friends and family too, right? You know, because they're
Yes.
not specific, and these aren't specific investment presentations, more or less. They're bigger picture that I think there's value to everybody, regardless, you know, from high net worth individuals to lower net worth individuals. I think there's value added into all of them. And maybe when, you know, someone listens to one of our podcasts and said, well, I never really thought about that. And then it really helps them because they don't make a big mistake, right? A lot of the planning is don't make the mistakes.
Exactly. And these aren't sales pitch podcasts. If you pass it on to somebody, it's not that we expect them to give us a call and say, hey, we want to do business with you. We just want to spread the education, spread some information, and, you know, hopefully it helps everybody in the long run. So with
Sounds
that
great.
being said, share it with your friends and family, and we will chat with you all next time.
Sounds
Talk to you
good.
later.
Thanks
Thank
again,
you.
guys.